From Daylight and Media 3 Limited, I'm Kazuki Akiba.
And I'm Brandon Beiser.
And this is a new season of Sayonara Baseball. This is a podcast where you and I find unseen baseball gems by analyzing them alongside different trends, news, and motivation behind many moves around the league today.
And today, we'll talk about the connection between Cornell University and the history of baseball.
Fernando Tatis Jr., a grand slam!
Welcome back to Sayonara Baseball. I'm Kazuki, and here with me is Brandon again, and we're going to be exploring Cornell baseball.
Thank you, Kazuki, and thank you again, everyone, for listening. This is our second off-season episode, and first, like of all, wish you a happy new year, happy 2021. This episode is a special one. I'll give you a little bit of the background on this episode. When I was at Cornell University as a student 10 years ago, there was a class called The First American University about the history of Cornell. And one of the lectures was about sports history as it relates to Cornell. The class has now been going on for 10 years, and the course material has disseminated out to the alumni over the years. In 2020, the class went virtual when the whole university went virtual in the spring of 2020. Alumni were allowed to come back in and visit the class. I listened in on the sports episode again, the sports lecture, and I found the new stories that I forgot about utterly fascinating. Therefore, Kazuki and I are very, very honored to offer you the instructor of that course, Corey Ryan Earle. Corey Ryan Earle is a 2007 graduate of Cornell University. He is, by title, officially an alumni affairs official at the university, which is interesting as an alumni. He is also the lecturer of the First American University, going on its 10th anniversary in 2021. Today, we're going to have a formal explanation and story time with Corey about how Cornell University has become a centerpiece in some of the most odd, interesting, and frankly, creative moments in baseball history. We hope you enjoy today's episode with Corey Ryan Earle.
Coming up after the break, we'll be having our conversation with Corey Earle.
Are experimenting aggressively with the automated strike zone. We used it in the Atlantic League this year.
Welcome back to Sayonara Baseball. It is our pleasure and honor to introduce our guest today, Corey Ryan Earle, the instructor of the First American University at Cornell University, the unofficial historian of Cornell University, and by title, an alumni affairs official at Cornell University. Corey Ryan Earle, thank you for joining us today on Sayonara Baseball.
It's a pleasure to be here. I've never thought of myself as an expert on baseball, but I'm at least an expert on Cornell history, and there's a little bit of overlap there.
Yes, there is a little overlap. And with that, we'll start with our first pitch, our opening question today. And our first pitch truly is a first pitch. How did baseball even start as a sport at Cornell University?
A great question to start things off here. Cornell isn't really thought of as a baseball school, or it's not something that people think of when asked about sports at Cornell, hockey probably being the sport that comes to mind generally. But we've won an Ivy League title or two in our time, although I think only one in the last 35 years. But baseball is the oldest sport at Cornell. It was one of the first activities that early students organized on campus. So Cornell opens in October of 1868. That's the first time that students arrive on campus. And to put it into context in terms of baseball history, I feel like baseball really peaks or begins to peak in the 1850s. You see a lot of popularity nationally of baseball. So Cornell's being founded not that much longer after a real peak in popularity of baseball. For instance, the National Association of Baseball Players is formed just over a decade before Cornell is founded. And so that marks the growing popularity of the sport. It makes sense that Cornell students would be interested in the sport when Cornell opens. And that first year of students on campus, there really aren't organized student activities, but you see the students start talking about playing baseball. The student newspaper forms and tries to prod students into organizing a formal team a couple of times. And then in spring of that first year, in April, the student newspaper runs a story and it says, "We have in this university a large number of fine baseball players, men who have played in important positions in some of the first clubs in the country." And basically says, "Why don't you guys put together a real team and start playing baseball on campus?" And that's what happens. By May of that first year, after Cornell opened in October, students finally get together and put together a ball club. And they officially ask the university, "Hey, can we make an official team and have some space on campus to play ball?" The student newspaper says, "With the return of warmer weather, balls innumerable are seen flying across the campus." And the rest is history.
That's amazing. I guess that's really interesting that the history of baseball in its early years really peaked at the same time Cornell was created. Now, the next question I have is, did the founder, did Ezra Cornell, have any influence really in kind of the formulation of baseball? Because he was a very different leader when it comes to creating university as the creation of the course was built on. How did he influence the beginnings of baseball at Cornell?
Yeah, so both Cornell's two founders, you have the president, Andrew Dixon White, and then the founder and namesake, Ezra Cornell, they're both around in those early years and playing a pretty big part on campus. And so the story goes that the students went to the president and petitioned the president saying, "We want to form a ball club. Can we have permission to play baseball on campus?" And the president said, "Sure, I'm on board with that." He thought physical activity was an important part of education. And then they go to Ezra Cornell, and the issue was that Ezra's farm was adjacent to the campus, and they wanted to build a field a little bit past the boundary of campus on Ezra's personal pasture. And so they went to him and said, "Hey, Ezra, you know, would it be okay if we put a baseball field on your pasture right next to campus, south of campus?" And then for those of you who know campus, this is about where the main library building is today, Olin Library, so a little bit south of the main arts quad. And Ezra says, "Sure, you can build a baseball field on my pasture. That's fine with me." But the players weren't quite satisfied with that. They went back to him and said, "Would you be willing to make a cash contribution to our baseball club? We need to buy equipment. We need bats and balls, etc." And Ezra's response there was a little less generous. The story goes that he responded by saying, "When I was a boy and wanted to play ball, my mother took an old stocking and unraveled it and wound the yarn into the ball. And I found an old boot top and cut out the leather and covered the ball. And I think it ought to be good enough for you." So he declined to give them any financial support for the team, but did at least give them the land to build a baseball field.
So the first field was built on both on campus and part of Ezra Cornell's personal pasture. I love the quote. That's such a very like dignified quote. It's like from a farming perspective, like, "Well, my mother made me do this and you're going to do the same thing." So that's really interesting that Cornell and Andrew Dixon White had some influence over the start of baseball at Cornell. And then we have baseball at Cornell for several years. And then you, before to our conversation, you sent me over a list of names and topics that I was just generally curious about. And I am curious to learn about the first one, which was in the early years of Cornell baseball, there were two names, Hugh Jennings and Billy Evans. And you said they are the first great players of Cornell baseball because they went to the Hall of Fame.
They're the only two Cornellians in the Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown. So they are arguably the two most famous names in Cornell baseball. They weren't necessarily the most famous or best players on campus when they were students, but after Cornell, they had the most impact on the sport of baseball as Hall of Fame inductees. And so Huey Jennings, both of them were actually at Cornell at the same time, right in the early 1900s, those first few years of the century. And neither of them actually graduated from Cornell. They both left campus before finishing their degrees. But back then, it was more common to do that. A lot of people would come, get a few years of education, and then leave with that to pursue their career. So Jennings came to Cornell. Huey Jennings, he had already established himself on the national level as a baseball player. He had won 3 National League titles with the Baltimore Orioles. He had won 2 titles with the Brooklyn Superbas. And then he came to Cornell to study law after already playing professional baseball. And while he was a student, he decided to become the coach of Cornell's baseball team. They had no formal coach. And so he sort of took it over and led the baseball team in those early years. And then after he leaves Cornell, he does practice law when he wasn't playing baseball, sort of on the off season. But he becomes the manager of the Detroit Tigers and leads the Detroit Tigers to 3 World Series. And then he later coaches the New York Giants. He becomes the first Cornellian to win a World Series with the Giants in 1921. And then he wins again in 1922. So he has quite a successful baseball career, both before Cornell and after Cornell.
Impressive. So that's just the Hugh Jennings story. So he comes to Cornell after playing in the, what you said it was the National League or the National Association of Baseball as an Orioles player with the Brooklyn, what was that, the Brooklyn team?
Brooklyn Super Baws, which I'm not sure what a Super Baw is, but that was the name of their major league team at the time.
And then he comes to Cornell, studies law for however many years, coaches the team, and then goes out and wins at three World Series of the Tigers.
I think they didn't win those World Series. So
he made the World Series three times with the Tigers and then won his first one with the Giants.
And then won another with the Giants the next year. They had two in a row.
Okay, so then the next question is where does Billy Evans fit in this story?
Well, before I get to Evans, I should mention my favorite Huey Jennings fact. Huey Jennings still has a couple records in Major League Baseball. He has the record for being hit with a pitch in one season more than any other person. That's 51 times in a single season. And he has the record for being hit with a pitch more times in a career than any other professional player. He has the record with 287 times he was hit with a pitch. And he actually was considered to be quite accident prone throughout his career. While at Cornell, he famously dove into a swimming pool at night without realizing that it had been emptied. And he fractured his skull diving into the pool. He later was in a bad car accident. So he was a bit of a klutz, I guess, in that respect. But I think it's a fun fact that he still has this record for being hit with the ball.
Okay, so we'll do that again. He has the record for the most hit by pitches in a single season and in an entire major professional career.
And I think just within the last few decades, someone got close to breaking that career record. I think Jennings had 287, and someone got 285 or so in the last few years.
It might be Craig Biggio, because he's been known to get hit by the pitch quite often, especially in his like early days in the league, because he crouched the plate way too much than he is. So maybe that's him. So he might be following the OG right here, Jennings.
Nice. Yeah, I don't know what Jennings' strategy was that caused him to be hit so much.
I just like how you gently called him accident prone. That's a nice way of putting it. Like, the guy got hit almost 300 times for playing Major League Baseball. That's nice. All right, so now we have Hugh Jennings. We have learned about the first Hall of Famer from Cornell's history. Though I presume that is the stat about the hit by the pitches? I'm pretty sure that's got to be on his plaque. That's got to be on plaque.
So. I assume so. I'm not sure. That's a good question.
That's a great question. We have to call someone at the National Baseball Hall of Fame, ask him. Is the Hugh Jennings hit by the pitch stat on there? But the other person at the same era of time in both baseball and Cornell is Billy Evans.
Yeah, so Billy Evans also studies law at Cornell. He also doesn't graduate at Cornell. But gets involved in professional baseball, but he becomes an umpire. He actually becomes a major league umpire at the age of 22, the youngest umpire in major league history. And he becomes one of the youngest officials in a World Series game at the age of 25. I think he might have been the youngest ever at the time when he officiates the World Series. And he is the third umpire inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame. And the other fact about him beyond his umpiring, he retires from being an umpire, and then he becomes the general manager of the Cleveland Indians in 1927. And I believe he is the first person in Major League Baseball history to have the title of general manager. Although the position had existed in concept, the term general manager hadn't been used until Billy Evans came along.
Billy Evans becomes the first, we assume the first bi-title general manager in baseball history, which is interesting as... We'll get back to the general manager connection at Cornell later on in today's episode, because it's very interesting how that will tie into the very last thing we probably talk about today. So we have our one and two Hall of Famers, Billy Evans and Hugh Jennings. And then as we go a couple years later, you wrote in a note to me, Lou Gehrig and home run. There's a Lou Gehrig home run at Cornell? Lou Gehrig played college baseball?
Yeah, a lot of people don't realize that Lou Gehrig played for Columbia. He played on Columbia's baseball team in the 1920s. And Cornell's field, Hoy Field, opens in 1922. And a lot of people don't realize this, but I think Cornell's field is one of the oldest college baseball fields in the country. It opened in 1922 as Hoy Field. And I think that makes it the fourth old on-campus D1 baseball field in the United States. I think the only older schools are Michigan State, Oregon State, and Holy Cross. But all of those got their names more recently. Cornell's is the only one to have the continuous name since 1922, making it the oldest continuously named D1 baseball field. But firsts are always a dangerous game. It's always, you know, there's always someone who can come up with another first. So it's safe to say it's one of the oldest, if not the oldest. And a year after that field opens in 1922, Garrick comes to town with the Columbia baseball field. They play there, or the Columbia baseball team. They play there on April 21st, 1923 on Cornell's Hoy Field. And Garrick hit the second ever home run on Cornell's home field. The first home run was a guy named Murray from Syracuse. Not sure he went on to any acclaim, and people sort of forget his story, but you often hear the story that Garrick hit the first home run at Cornell. It was actually the second, but a pretty neat claim to fame that, that Cornell's field had this early Lou Gehrig home run.
So Lou Gehrig, do you know how many seasons he played at Columbia? I've heard it was he didn't graduate from Columbia, obviously.
Right. I don't know how many seasons he played. I don't think it was a full four seasons, and he didn't spend 4 years at Columbia.
So he hit one of the most notable home runs, at least the second home run in Cornell home field history. And is Hoy Field still the same Hoy Field that I remember it as? It's a low field. It opens up to what is now the engineering quad. And if he hit a home run the way I think he can hit a home run, he put a charge in that. That's going into the forest.
Yeah, that's right. It's considered one of the best home runs on the field. So there was someone who tried calculating how far it went in the modern day just a few years ago. They tried to look at old reports and see if they could figure out how long a home run it was. But I think they concluded that it went towards the gorge into the woods and you know was quite a feat. But today that would be impossible to hit because there's an engineering building in the way. The field points towards Rhodes Hall. The only major changes to the field over the years, obviously it's been renovated and updated since 1922, but it has rotated too. It used to face a little bit different direction, but they've changed the orientation of the field as buildings have been built up around it.
So I found the fact, he only studied for 2 years before going on to play for the Yankees.
So he got his start hitting home runs at Cornell.
Right. Yeah, that's all you guys could put a claim on.
And it's interesting, so our listeners know, Hoy Field is a very simple baseball field. It's a simple college baseball field. And in today's era, if he were to hit the distance of a home run that he hit from it, it would probably break the glass of what is now Rhodes Hall, which is a beautiful curved building on the curved road that leads into Cornell's campus. Because Hoy Field now sits kind of in between a bunch of really tall structures, a parking garage. There's another glass sciences building, engineering building, and then there's a hotel school on its far right foul on the foul line. And it's a really interesting setup for a baseball team. So I'm thinking like, what would Lou Gehrig's home look like today? It would break a ton of windows. I mean, it would have to do that.
Yeah, when the field was built, there wasn't much around it. They had just begun developing the athletic fields in that area. There weren't any other buildings in the near vicinity. So it was sort of on its own, but very different now. And that game, by the way, Columbia did win the game. I think it was a score of 8-3 that Lou Gehrig led Columbia to defeat Cornell.
Of course they won the game. It's Lou Gehrig. You know, he can't lose. And then the next obvious, wonderfully famous name in baseball history that has a connection to Cornell is Babe Ruth. And you just wrote the word strikeout. Babe Ruth struck out at Cornell.
So it wasn't at Cornell. I should mention before we leave the Hoy Field topic, I thought of another person who probably deserves mention, possibly the next most famous person to play on Hoy Field is George Herbert Walker Bush, who visited Cornell in 1946 as the first baseman for Yale's varsity baseball team. He split a pair of games in 1946. He returned again in 1948 as captain of Yale's baseball team and led the team to a 4-3 victory on Hoy Field. So another notable individual, perhaps not as notable for his work in baseball, but I thought that was worth mentioning in terms of Hoy Field. But talking about Babe Ruth, I don't think Babe Ruth has played on Hoy Field, not to my knowledge, but there is a Cornellian who claims one of his proudest moments was striking out Babe Ruth. And that's a Cornellian who went on to play professionally. His name was Ole Olson, or at least he went by the nickname of Ole. class of 1920 from Cornell. He was captain of Cornell's baseball team, and he pitched in the minor and major leagues after graduating from Cornell, including with the Detroit Tigers. And one of his favorite memories was in 1922, the Tigers played against Babe Ruth, and Ruth allegedly taunted him as the pitcher and said, "Throw the ball and duck." And Mr. Olson didn't take very kindly to that. He allegedly responded by calling Babe a big baboon. I don't know if that was the best comeback, but then struck out Babe Ruth. And that was something that Mr. Olson kept with him throughout his life, telling the story about how he struck out Babe Ruth.
It's a very interesting dichotomy. You have Lou Gehrig celebration of hitting something against a Cornellian. Obviously, he had a tremendous home run. And then a professional at bat, Ole Olson strikes out in Kazuki can chime in on this. Like, well, we see that all the time now, people taunting each other on the baseball field like that. And to strike out, it's like an interesting connection that I have. So one of my friends from Cornell's high school classmate, his first ever at bat was he pitched to Derek Jeter.
Wow.
He didn't go to college. He was a draft pick of the Kansas City Royals. You got to look him up. His name is Danny Duffy from Lompoc, California. And his first at bat is facing Derek Jeter. And you can just see on his face, like his face lights up. He's like, oh my gosh, I have to face Derek Jeter. So I can imagine this is what Olson probably felt like facing Babe Ruth. And he just gets taunted by him, strikes him out. And oh, I definitely consider that my proudest accomplishment as an athlete.
Yeah, I think Olson had a long career in baseball, so I can see how that moment would stick with him.
That's definitely a good one. And then the final memory, before I go there, I like that with the one thing, a president played baseball at Cornell, played baseball versus Cornell University. That's a good one. Just George Herbert Walker Bush.
Funny part is he also played only for 2 years and then moved on.
Right. So it's interesting. So we got an interesting connection between, you know, a president, and we have two of probably arguably the best baseball players of all time. And then I have come to learn about this story you call the curved bat story of Frank Olin. And I'll let you give it back about Frank Olin, but I'm presuming this is the Frank Olin that also has the name on the building at Cornell University too.
Yes. So Franklin Olin was one of the first baseball stars at Cornell. He was in the class of 1886. So this is going back pretty far in Cornell history. And he was one of the people who back then paid his way through college by playing professional baseball in several leagues. It wasn't uncommon for some of these early students to play baseball when they weren't busy with classes and use some of their pay from that to get through college. And so he played baseball while he was an engineering student at Cornell. And he was best known for playing with a curved bat that he had designed and engineered himself from a wagon tongue. And he would hit, so the curved part curved outwards, and he reasoned that it allowed him to hit the ball in the exact center by hitting the ball with the curve of this bat. It gave him more precision when hitting the bat, and he used that in these professional leagues. Obviously, there were fewer rules and regulations on what was an official regulation bat at the time. Today, he's best remembered not as a professional baseball player, but he founded the Olin Corporation, which was this enormous industrial manufacturing company, a very notable company for many decades. And between Franklin Olin and his three children and the family's philanthropy, there are 78 Olin buildings on college campuses around the country. They funded buildings and programs at colleges all over. I think there are 58 institutions and 78 Olin halls. And there were four separate buildings at Cornell named after members of the Olin family. So a pretty influential family beyond the baseball world.
I'm not surprised that some Cornellian put his name on a bunch of buildings. That's a typical trope about Cornellians. I love the story about the curved bat. And I have to admit, when you first sent me that story, you said Olin, Frank Olin curved bat, I Googled it. And there was one link from the Sabermetrics, like the people behind Sabermetrics, and they explain why he built it. Like, it's a perfect engineering story. He's like, I figured I could do better if I had a curved bat. And you think about today's bats, about like wooden bats versus metal bats, is a very basic one. They're like where the center is. Like he was the first person to figure out where the sweet spot was in a bat. And like that concept originated from like a legal bat now, but the concept of find a sweet spot in a bat. And he used it, and then obviously engineering mind like his was used for greater talents beyond baseball in the industrial world. And he created all these amazing things and became exceedingly wealthy with his family and his sons. So it's just interesting, like how you said in the early years, we've talked about four or five stories at least, these early connections to the founding of baseball at Cornell, to the stories about bats and famous baseball players and great accomplishments. And now we'll skip several years, many years into the future, about other influences in baseball from Cornell. And I'm curious to hear about the story about Rob Nelson. Rob Nelson is the founder and creator of Big League Chew, which is the most notorious candy associated, other than probably Cracker Jacks, with baseball.
Yeah, so Rob Nelson was in the class of 1971 at Cornell. So we're going forward almost a century here. He played baseball at Cornell, and he played in a few minor leagues and some international leagues after graduation. I don't think he ever made it to any major league teams, but he did continue his passion for baseball. And my understanding of the story is that he always sort of admired that image of a professional baseball player chewing tobacco, you know, out there on the field. But he understood that perhaps chewing tobacco wasn't the healthiest habit to pick up. And so he talked about how he would take a stick of gum or a wad of gum and stick it in his cheek and use that to sort of emulate the chewing tobacco. So he wanted to create a bubble gum that would emulate that image for baseball players of chewing and spitting tobacco. And he came up with this idea of shredded bubble gum and teamed up with some other people who helped him shape the idea and trademark the idea of Big League Chew, and got some equipment to start manufacturing gum. I think his first production run, he was cutting the gum himself to create the idea of the shredded gum. But in the end, he comes up with this new idea. And I think, I'm not sure he still does this, but for many years, he was providing free Big League Chew to the Cornell teams. I think the baseball and softball team got free Big League Chew. And it was sort of the unofficial gum or snack of the Cornell teams. But he stays connected to the Cornell team to this day.
I have never had Big League Chew. Kazuki, you play baseball. Have you had Big League Chew?
I played in California. Our friends in California were chewing even during like batting cage practices, like at a batting cage in Gardena. Like, what are you guys doing? But it's that like notable, like, you know, whenever you see a gum, you think of that, you know, big guy, muscular guy figure. And you see, it's like, oh, that's the gum I need to get.
Right. And I think as just an aside from that, I know that's a direct invention that came from going into baseball. As a quick aside from that, we think about food today at baseball stadiums. And I will toot my own horn a little bit as a Cornell graduate from the hotel school. Many of the stadiums that we probably go to have been influenced by hotel school graduates in the food that's served there. I think of the companies like Aramark, Levy Restaurants, DNC Sports Services, all those have some Cornell connection, at least from my year. At least I know I think of one person from my year who worked at a different baseball stadium in the concessions and or the corporate office for each of those. So it's interesting how the Cornell connection with both the engineering, we had engineering, we had food science, that we have, obviously, if you go to the food itself, you'll see it night and very clearly. So, and that leads us to, I would say, the first more common contemporary person that came from baseball at Cornell, who's currently involved in a leadership role, but in another league. And that's Deputy Commissioner of the National Basketball Association, Mark Tatum.
Yeah, I figured if we're talking about famous Cornellians from baseball or affiliated with baseball, it was worth bringing him up, even though he's in the NBA now, the Deputy Commissioner. But Mark Tatum graduated from Cornell in 1991, and he played a couple seasons of baseball at Cornell. And he, before he joined the NBA, he did work for Major League Baseball. So he did follow his baseball passion for a number of years before switching leagues and getting involved in the NBA.
And I'll use this moment to bring a point that we're going to bring about in a second. Cornell has this very unique school on campus called the School of Industrial Labor Relations. And that school has become like this feeder system for professional sports executives of all levels, because it's and I'll let Corey explain a little bit better, but it's one, if not the only school at an undergraduate level that teaches people about labor and union management, which are significant throughout most professional sports leagues, baseball more notoriously and recently because they had strikes, they've had the formations of all the major unions, MLBPA. And as an aside to the union thing, I don't think he was a graduate of the ILR school, but the president of the NFLPA in 2020 was elected, is a Cornellian. J.C. Tretter, who is a center on the playoff-bound Cleveland Browns. And so it's just interesting about that, how that school and that lesson from that school has connected to all professional sports, baseball in particular.
Yeah, I think Tretter actually might be a graduate of the ILR school. I think that that may have been what he studied. Tatum did not. I think he was in the business program at Cornell. But when you look at the other major sports leagues, so currently the NHL is led by Commissioner Gary Bettman, who is a graduate of the ILR school at Cornell. And then going over to Major League Baseball, we have Rob Manfred, a graduate of the ILR school, class of 1980. And so you do have Cornellians in the main office of these two leagues, using what they learned at Cornell about managing unions and labor and applying that in the real world.
And I did just figure it out on the ILR website, famous alumni, J.C. Tretter, class 2013. So I'm not surprised. I went to school with both J.C. and his sister. So it's interesting that that they are both featured here, that name. Can you give us a little bit more context about the ILR school? Just because it's so unique and like its connection to professional sports, let alone baseball, and obviously the current commissioner, Rob Manfred, like the concept behind the school, any history behind that school, just because, like I said, it's rather unique. And usually you would see a lot of people go to law school and that's how they would get into this field. But at Cornell, it's a four-year undergraduate major, which is rather different when you look at the rest of the undergraduate landscape across America.
Yeah, the sports connection probably wasn't what they had in mind when they started the school. Today, it has a really strong sports business society. I know they have a lot of programming around sports management, but it started back in 1945. So it's a little younger than the other schools at Cornell. And it was the first of its kind. And it basically came out of the New York State Legislature. There was a commission in the New York State Legislature looking at disputes and conflict between labor and management. And what can New York State do better to address conflict between these two constituencies? And this joint commission decides that the best way to solve disputes between labor and management is better education, more mediation and dispute management, but educating people to deal with these issues, educating people who will go on to leadership roles in labor, in management. And so they concluded that, well, we've got this great university in Ithaca, New York, that has an affiliation with the state of New York as the land-grant institution of the state. There were several colleges at Cornell that were state-affiliated or contract colleges where the state helped fund aspects of those programs and in return for fulfilling needs that the state saw as important. For instance, the College of Agriculture, the College of Veterinary Medicine, those both came out of this idea of supporting the needs of the state. And so the state basically works with Cornell in the 1940s to establish this new type of school, a school of industrial and labor relations. And the idea was to bring together people to deal with conflict between labor and management.
That's the interesting point is, like you said, that's a state funded school, a state contracted school. And Cornell is unique and it has a split. There are contract colleges and there are private colleges. I went to the hotel school, which is a private college, which shares a quad with the ILR school, which is the contract college. And at school, there's no like way, you obviously know as a student, you're paying tuition, you know which is our which, but there's no difference when you're on campus pretty much. They're all just buildings in that sense. It's like you said, they have a very just unintended, powerful connection with sports these days. And I think because the growth of unions and the prevalence of unions in all of these sports, like you said, two current commissioners are ILR grads, Bettman and Manfred. We've had other connections throughout other schools at Cornell professional sports leagues. Most recently, in 2020, the president of the Drone Racing League is a former NBA executive, Rachel Jacobson, from the Cornell Hotel School. Tatum, who is a business graduate from, I think, the Ag School, is now the deputy commissioner of the NBA. He also we all get to see him every year. If you're an NBA fan, he announces the draft picks in the second round. So it's always very interesting. And I guess another aside for this is sports media. It's not something we kind of brought up, but ESPN, Jimmy Pitaro, is a Cornell graduate, which I think is an interesting concept. And then several prolific reporters at Cornell from like the public side, prolific reporters at ESPN are all Cornellians too. The Schapp family, Sarah Spain, Keith Olbermann, which is another one. He was the president. He was in charge of WVBR, the radio station in Ithaca when he was there. So it's just like these, like you said, we Kazuki and I, we kind of built this idea. We were thinking of all these connections, and we started, it just spiraled. Like, we knew the Manfred one, we knew the Bettman one. We didn't know a lot of the early ones, and the current ones, it gets even more interesting with the story of John Daniels and AJ Preller. So we go back to our general manager connection from earlier. I have met John Daniels because when I lived in Texas, he invited the Cornell Alumni Association from North Texas to a game. I had no idea who this man was. And talk about a connection to the Bush family. The Bush family owned the team, owned the Rangers, I think before he became general manager. But I'll tell you what I know about Preller and Daniels, and I'll let you kind of, they were in school together. And they were in the same fraternity?
Correct. So they were classmates, both class of 1999. I think it was Delta Chi fraternity. I'm not positive on that, but we're friends, knew each other well in college, and then ended up being colleagues.
Right. So, and I'll provide a little bit of information that Corey gave me, if there's any other connection we can think of along the way. So John Daniels and both AJ Preller both graduate and work in banking for a number of years. And then Daniels takes a job, his first job in baseball, and then works his way up into the Rangers organization and becomes the youngest general manager in history. I remember he said that to us, and I was just kind of floored. It's like, he looked really young when he became the general manager. And he's been the general manager for, I think, over a decade now with the Rangers. I mean, it's been a while. And obviously one of the people he brought on at some point was AJ Preller, his Cornell fraternity brother and classmate, who is now the general manager of the Slam Diego Padres, who have been all over for our fan, our audience, who are baseball fans. They are the most active franchise right now in the current offseason. So to think about him and Daniels is like in cahoots, because I think they brought in like players like Alex Rodriguez, Alfonso Soriano. Like, they were there when all this happened, Major League World Series. And now Preller is spending money like he's got nobody else, that nobody, no care in the world with the San Diego Padres. That's just an incredible story to have these two people that are interwoven at Cornell. Obviously come back to you. That's a very Cornell thing to do, is like they'll work together, but they now are in rival franchises. And AJ Preller right now is on a tear in terms of like popularity. I mean, he's been in the news almost every week once his team got really good. I mean, they have a great ball field in San Diego. It's just incredible to kind of think about those recent connections to baseball.
That shows you never know, like who you meet in college. You know, your fraternity brother or someone you have class with might end up being a coworker or a rival a few years down the road. I think Preller served as the assistant GM to Daniels for the Rangers before Preller became GM of the Padres. So it's pretty neat that they had the chance to work together and now work as rivals in a sense in the same industry. Pretty neat connection.
Yeah, the rivals thing with other industries that are less sports related is something that's common in with Cornellians, especially engineering and medicine. I think the other thing is, I'm just curious if we know this now, are there any relatively recent Cornellians that were drafted or play in the majors?
I don't think we've had anyone actually play in the majors in some time. I believe there have been a few people drafted and played in the minor leagues, but no one has made it to the majors in decades.
I'm trying to think of the last Ivy Leaguer to make it to the majors other than Chris Young at Princeton, who is now, he is an official with the Texas Rangers, of all the things to kind of circle us back to where we are. He was a pitcher for, isn't that just odd, Kazuki? He was a pitcher for the Padres.
Yeah, and now
he got traded to the Rangers. And he goes, works Major League Baseball with Manfred. Talk about this guy who took a very Cornell circulation of things. And now he is, I believe, the director of baseball operations or in the baseball ops field with the Rangers. So that's the last, I guess, notable Ivy Leaguer who everyone talks about. Because like I said, most of the Ivy Leaguers from at least Cornell are hockey players, football. We've had a few Olympians, both men and women's. But the baseball field has definitely been dominated by them, been the business side with that. And I'm sure at some point we're going to have people in the sciences field come out with sports performance and all those things related to that, because I think that's definitely been a huge boom for Cornell in terms of the medical school. And Cornell recently founded the tech campus in New York City. So it's just, like I said, we wanted to bring you on to talk about this today, and we're grateful that you brought this on. And we'll go out on this as our final segment. We'll call Three Strikes and You're Out, very baseball appropriate. Could you share with us your favorite baseball team?
My favorite baseball team. Well, I've never been someone who followed baseball closely, but my father was born in Vermont, and as a Vermonter, their favorite team, he says, was Boston Red Sox, because they didn't have their own team to cheer for. So growing up, I very much had Boston Red Sox discussed in the household. And since he was a faculty member at Cornell, he would often have some friendly rivalries going with all the Yankee fans in his classes. That was pretty common for him. So I'd hear stories of that frequently. And he did have one of his former students go and work for Aramark. And he had someone go and work for Fenway Park, who would send him tickets to a game, Red Sox game each year. So I remember when I was younger going to some games at Fenway to see the Red Sox play. So I'd say that's probably the number one team for me.
I'm so sorry, Kazuki. We've had two guests in a row now that are Red Sox fans.
Red Sox fans. I know. He's a Yankees fan. I just can't relive the past.
Can't relive the past.
So, also, you might not know this, but Dave Dombrowski, who's I think currently with the Phillies as the president of baseball operations, but he is a Cornellian, formerly president of the Red Sox, and led them to the World Series in 2018. He's class of 1978 from Cornell.
So wow, look at that.
Late breaking news in the podcast. Dave Dombrowski, another baseball executive from the, he said 79?
I think 78. I think he might have transferred out or didn't finish at Cornell, but was a Cornell student.
We got to look this up now. So, we got to look this up.
News in the podcast. Dave Dombrowski has a Cornell connection. Not surprising.
And another reason I picked the Red Sox is, I don't know if you know Alex Jimenez, but I think another ILR grad from Cornell, he's class of 2015. He is the coordinator of major league operations for the Red Sox, and has done quite well with them over the last few years. And so he's someone I knew as a student and have kept in touch with a little bit. So another Cornellian working his way up in the business.
Yeah, Dombrowski briefly played football for Cornell.
Huh.
There you go. Late breaking news in the pod. So we have in breaking
for
news.
For 1 year.
1 year.
We'll count it.
We'll put it on the board. Definitely on the board. So I guess
if you guys want to be part of any sports organization, go to Cornell. That's the message is.
Yeah, it's the Ivy League connection is obviously very strong with a lot of different institutions. Like we said, the whole reason we brought you on today was this very interesting connection that Cornell has with baseball history and baseball today. Then our next question in the Three Strikes and You're Out segment is, you're probably going to be, I think I know the answer, baseball stadium of note of going to or visiting as your favorite. And it sounds like it's going to be Fenway Park, which is.
I suppose Hoy Field doesn't count.
Hoy Field can count. It'll make Kazuki happy because he won't talk about Boston Red Sox anymore.
I think I may have been to one game at Hoy Field. I mean, baseball at Cornell isn't really seen as much of a spectator sport. I'll admit they don't bring in a huge number of fans. So I'd probably say Fenway is the one that I have the most connection with of going to games.
I will give my favorite Hoy Field memory because when I went to Cornell, there's a building now called Gates Hall. If you look at a Cornell map, Gates Hall sits in between Statler Hall, where the hotel school is, and the Hoy Field, the baseball stadium. If you sat in the corner of the three-level atrium at the hotel school, you could look into right field perfectly, unobstructed. So it was like the skybox seats. So I would hold my office hours for class right there on baseball games because our friend was on the baseball team. And I would just watch him play and I'd have my office hours in this little atrium area right there. And the other one is there's now a parking garage in the left field foul line. And I jokingly called it, but I think maybe it's a thing now. Like there were like tailgaters for baseball and they would just sit on the top deck of the parking garage and they would just like barbecue and everything and watch baseball. And I'm sure that still goes on when it's warm enough outside. But I think that was a very interesting fact about Hoy Field. It's like you can do all these great things because it just kind of sits there. It's very open. It's a pretty simple baseball stadium, but it's like I said, it's a classic. It's really simple. It's not
parking garage right between the football stadium and the baseball field. So if you can tailgate, you know, on the parking garage, and depending on the season, you can look out and watch either sport.
And then our third strike in our this question is: of all the Cornellians associated with baseball and baseball players, who would you say is your your one that you remember the fondest or your favorite Cornell baseball affiliated person?
I do like Jennings just because of the stories of him getting hit with pitches. And I think that's kind of a fun record to have. But there's one Cornellian we didn't mention, and that's Harold Seymour. He got his PhD in 1956. And I don't know if you're familiar with the name Harold Seymour, but he wrote what is believed to be the very first doctoral dissertation on the topic of baseball. The first doctor of baseball. He had been a bat boy for the Brooklyn Dodgers, apparently, and just loved baseball, very passionate about it. And he ended up turning his doctoral thesis into a 3-volume history published by Oxford University Press, considered sort of the seminal work in baseball scholarship. And I think he's got a pretty cool story in that he wrote this first baseball dissertation. And he also, I think, is credited partly with being one of the historians who debunked the myth of Abner Doubleday inventing baseball at Cooperstown, which is sort of considered apocryphal at this point. But he was one of the researchers who went in and really studied the academic history of baseball before that was a thing.
That's incredible. I remember the Harold Seymour mention a while ago in your note originally too. And I personally love how you took that question to favorite baseball player, the guy who basically debunked the provisionary founding of baseball. Doubleday Field is, I think, one of the most original names. That's still the field name in Cooperstown. And the fact that he has a published volume as the first doctoral research-based dissertation on the subject of baseball is incredible. That's a great story. And I think that kind of perfectly leads into what I call the bonus question for the three strikes round, the golden sombrero question. If there was a topic based on what we talked about today that you would encourage us to share with our audience in the future, what would it be about baseball?
A topic related to baseball that you could dig into deeper. Would it need to be related to the things we've talked about?
It could be adjacent to them. We're just curious because, like I said, we've scattered a lot of different topics. We talked about engineering. We talked about history. We talked about the most hit batter of all time. I mean, I'm just curious if you think one more topic is like, I wish someone would talk about this, what would it be?
One thing that comes to mind is looking at sort of we haven't talked much about coaches at all. I guess we mentioned Jennings, but you know, there are a lot of fascinating individuals like Cornell's baseball coach for 28 years was Ted Thorin. It's the only jersey number that's been retired at Cornell, Ted Thorin's number, because he was such a legendary coach. And he's in the American Baseball Coaches Association Hall of Fame. But he also played a role in developing baseball in other countries. And I think he's also in the Baseball Halls of Fame for Croatia and Austria, which is kind of cool that this Cornell college baseball coach played this role in developing the sport internationally. And I don't know if you've looked at some of the stories around baseball developing international, but that could be another fun connection there.
We haven't. On our previous podcast from our off-season guest, we talked about how baseball in America, people are fans of baseball in America viewed international baseball because during the pandemic, that's all we had for a while. We had Korean baseball. And it was like watching college baseball. I mean, college football, because they're all we knew before they really had fans come back. And even with the limited fans they had, it looked like such pageantry. They had dances, they had coordinated cheers, they had all these things. And like in American baseball, we kind of have that, but we don't really have that to the level that they do. And so it's interesting to talk about coaches, because I personally don't know much about coaches. I mean, one of our earlier podcasts, we talked about connections of like players and coaches currently, but where have they gone now? What have they done internationally? Because I can think of like the Croatia connection is really intriguing. Like there are baseball teams now in all sorts of countries that really don't think of as a baseball country, like Italy, England. There are very good baseball teams. They have teams that come with a Little League World Series from all these regions across the world that we personally don't really know much about. I think it's a great idea to kind of look into that. So international baseball, international youth baseball, international expansion of baseball. It's a very interesting topic. And on that, Corey, thank you very much for being here today. I know this was a very specific angle that we're looking at for baseball, but I think, at least I'm going to say, I came away with a lot of interesting facts about very common threads in baseball that I didn't know had a Cornell connection, even though I went to Cornell. And I thought, like, you think you know a lot about the school you graduated from. And I greatly appreciate your time today. I'll let Kazuki also end on that too, just to learn about these common threads that we see every day that we really didn't know how they were connected to something many years prior.
Yeah, thanks so much for being part of this. Like, I didn't know much about Cornell's history in terms of like having produced this many elite talent on the executive level. And, you know, they're the one who's changing the face of baseball or all the sports leagues around the world. So, wow. Like, thanks for letting us know. But on that note, I was wondering if there's something you want to like promote about yourself or any website you have that you want to bring to the audience.
Sure. Well, thank you both for the invitation to be on the podcast. It was a lot of fun to discuss this sort of unique little angle of Cornell history. And if any of the listeners want to learn more about Cornell history, I do give presentations regularly during the pandemic. They have all been over Zoom, so they're open to anyone, anywhere. And so if listeners want to go to blogs.cornell.edu/Cornell History, that's a link to a list of any upcoming presentations about Cornell history. And there's also a link to 30 or so recordings over the last 8-9 months about Cornell history related topics, all different types of topics, histories of the different schools at Cornell, different communities within Cornell. And so if anyone wants to learn more about a sort of perspective or angle on the university, feel free to check that out.
Well, thank you very much. And for those who are interested, they are all public. All you have to do is click on the link and watch or read, and they're all quite interesting. They go into topics from sports to the history of Cornell being what's called the first American university and so much more. And once again, thank you very much, Corey, for being a part of the Sayonara Baseball Podcast.
That's it for this episode of Sayonara Baseball. This episode of Sayonara Baseball is hosted and produced by me, Kazuki Akiba, and Brandon Beiser. This episode was edited by Kazuki Akiba, with additional research by Brandon Beiser. Our theme song is by Kay Margus. Sayonara Baseball is a production of Daylight and Media 3 Limited. We'll be back with another episode. If you like this podcast, please rate, review, and subscribe to our podcast as more people will know about this show. Go to daylightinteractive.com to see some exclusive updates and more about our upcoming shows. I'm Kazuki Akiba.
I'm Tara Horry.
And this has been Sayonara Baseball.